Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by a reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Today on our show, writer, filmmaker, actor, and playwright Gary Indiana stops by to talk about his new memoir, I Can Give You Anything But Love. We'll find out if he hates the 80s in New York more than I do, more than Laurie hates Nazis, more than Tom hates this introduction I'm doing. Frankly, I doubt it.
I love Nazis.
I thought that was a great introduction.
Tom talks to Carolina de Robertis about her novel, The Gods of Tango. BJ Novak was bumped again last week, unfortunately, when our interview with a head librarian at Cal State Northridge about their collection of antiquarian books related to native botany ran long. But he has graciously agreed to return. He's going to be on today's show. Joining me are my usual co-conspirators, the recently released and on parole Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
So good to be back.
And Laurie Weiner.
I'm his parole officer.
Are you a hard overlord?
I don't want to get into it.
Let's do the show. Gary Indiana is a writer, actor, a playwright, and a filmmaker. He's got an art show currently up at 356 Mission in downtown LA, and he's written a new memoir called I Can Give You Anything But Love. Gary Indiana, welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thanks.
You've been living in New York since the 70s, and you've seen it go from a squatter's paradise to kind of a yuppie situation right now, and I'd like to know, is that the reason you've been spending so much time in Cuba?
No, I've been spending a lot of time in Cuba because I like to be in Cuba.
Do you find you can get writing done when you're down there?
Well, I wrote this whole book there. It wasn't easier to write the book because the book took much longer than I thought it was going to. I thought it was going to be quick work. It didn't work out that way. It took 4 years.
And why not?
Well, the book was all written when somebody who was involved in, you know, making it publishable or whatever, said, you know, if somebody read this cold, they would think you were born behind the wheel of a Mazda on the Harbor Freeway. I had left out my entire childhood. And so I realized, well, I have to say something about this. So I wrote the whole thing about my childhood in one night. I mean, I did my family, my growing up, my training to be a jockey at Rockingham, all of that I did in one night, and because I didn't want to deal with it. I didn't come from a particularly happy family. Not that I think they were bad people, it's just, or that I was bad. I just think, you know, we were provincial people, not very well educated people, people who were not, I mean, I come from a working class, you know, and that was tough. It was tough to be gay. It was tough to be smart where I grew up. But we had books at home. We had, like, I know my parents were reading Faulkner and Truman Capote, of all people, and, well, also Kathleen Windsor, Forever Amber, and all of this bestseller things, Ship of Fools, you know, all the stuff of the day. I mean, there wasn't so much of a divide between middlebrow and highbrow literature at that time. People read everything because there wasn't a whole TV culture yet.
But
people
Faulkner still suggests a certain amount of intellectual curiosity. I mean, my parents certainly didn't read Faulkner in Baltimore. You know, I mean, I don't think that was in every household in the 50s.
Oh, I think that they got, like, Requiem for a Nun just for the, you know, corn cob scene or something. I mean, it was dirty. No, really.
You mentioned Truman Capote, and Laurie's formative reading experiences include In Cold Blood and Compulsion.
Reading them, you know, at night at 13, you know, in bed, and like the Manson trials going on, and, you know, so all, like all of that horror. And so you've written three books about famous American crimes. Was that, do you want to talk?
Before you ask the question, why don't we say what they are, actually? You wrote about the Menendez brothers?
Well, a fictionalized
Andrew
version
Cunahan,
of it.
A fictionalized version of Andrew Cunahan.
Somewhat fictionalized. And
the third one was?
It was the Kimes, the Kimes case.
Yeah. Right. Can you talk a little bit about why you're drawn to imagine those people? And
I had to go to France for a couple of weeks or something, right at the beginning of the Menendez trial, and I had been following it every step. And while I was in Paris, I was waiting for Jean-Jacques Schuel, which always has been an interminable thing, in a wine bar, and I had just gotten hold of some yellow legal pads, and I think very much under the influence of Thomas Bernhard. I just started writing about why I was so resentful that I always had to sit and wait for Jean-Jacques Schuel when I had an appointment with him anywhere for like much longer than politeness, you know. And I started writing that. And then I ran out of things to be resentful against him about, and I proceeded on to my brother and what I resented about my brother, my relationship to my brother. And that sort of naturally led into writing about these two brothers that I've been watching on TV on their trial, their murder trial. And then, you know, a friend, Leibowitz, also said, you know, none of us got out of bed for 6 months or whatever. Just turned it on first thing in the morning because it was such an extraordinary thing. And I realized that there were things in my childhood that very much connected to them. Not that I was ever abused, not that I was ever, I mean, it was not by my parents anyway, but there were some things that...
You wrote about one incident in the book.
And then a shotgun. Actually, I put it on them, but it was my family. You know, there was a shotgun in the closet. And when my father would get really loaded, sometimes he would... Well, there was this sort of comedy, you know. I mean, it was not real. It was a scary comedy. It was scary because at a certain... there's a moment I describe in it happening to them that actually happened to me and my brother, that one night as they were struggling with the car keys, they just stopped and looked at us across the room and started laughing. And we realized this is a piece of theater being done to terrorize us. Uh-huh. You know, that was like really... awful. I mean, I used a lot of my childhood to kind of get into what their mentality might have been. I don't know, you know, I don't know the truth of any of it, and I never claimed to.
Nabokov says that when he started to write his autobiography, that things, he remembered things that he hadn't remembered, that the doors kind of opened. Did you find that when you started writing this book?
Yeah. I mean, things that I had completely forgotten about came back, and then things that I remembered very clearly started to present themselves in a sort of different aspect when I tried to think about, okay, well, you remember it that way, but can that possibly be the way it happened, you know? And it's tricky. I mean, memory is very tricky. And but I love that. I mean, how Nabokov killed off his mother in that memoir, just in a parenthesis, lightning picnic.
The greatest parenthesis in the history of the English language.
Greatest parenthesis ever.
I think we could all agree.
I mean, I hate talking about myself. I hate writing about myself. You know, it's embarrassing. It's weird. But I did want to figure out if, to the extent that I could, like, why are you wired the weird way that you are? I mean, you know, why am I this mess, you know? I mean, this particular mess. I don't mind being a mess, but, like, why am I this particular mess? How did I manage to get, you know, into this condition as a human being?
I'm curious, when you finished the memoir, how much rewriting did you do?
I mean, there was more material. I had generated much more material than I used, and a lot of that I really was loath to get rid of. And, I mean, some of it was, like, brutal to have to throw out. But, you know, I can give you a very good reason why I didn't write a book that people expected to maybe thought would be because of that LA Times thing yesterday. You put one proper name in a book like this and it becomes about that proper
Susan
name.
Sontag.
Yeah. And I just thought this is so insulting in a way.
Gary's talking about the story in the LA Times yesterday, which referenced a piece of the book, of Gary's memoir, which is not a long piece, and it's about his relationship with Susan Sontag and his insights into her personality.
And in the review, it took an oversized role.
Well, you know, that was the headline, but the book isn't about her.
No.
It's about me, you know, and it's about, you know, having a hero or whatever, and then finding that their feet are made of clay or what, I mean, to put it in the corniest possible terms, but, you know, I mean, it wasn't there like as a red flag of, oh, you know, now we can talk about this book because there's a famous person in it. And I told the people yesterday that symposium, I said, if I could do one thing different, I would just take Susan Sontag out of this book because otherwise, you know, they would have to, the journalist would have to think about what he was reading, you know, I mean.
Well, it's so funny because I think most writers do the opposite. They'd write the book called I Knew Susan Sontag. It's like what you have with the guy.
But I knew everybody. I know everybody. My God, I've known every famous person you can possibly name. I mean, but I don't want to write that kind of a book. It's ridiculous. It's cheap.
nadie comprende lo que...
I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on KPFK FM, the LARB Radio Hour. We are talking to Gary, Indiana.
Solo, temblando de ansiedad yo estoy.
You've been through the publishing world in a lot of different ways and a lot of different times, and people have been talking about the crisis in publishing for the last decade or so. How's that affected your relation to your work?
I stopped publishing books for 10 years. I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just got sick of the whole business, and you know, I've had a really good experience with Rizzoli because they're not conventional publishers. Mm-hmm. People like me, like, you know, literary but slash experiment, however you get ghettoized as a literary person. Mm-hmm. I've heard it argued that they were paying unreasonably large advances to people like me. I never found them particularly unreasonable.
I don't see why you should.
And that they just decided to cut out the midlist. I mean, that they weren't going to give people enough money to live on. And, you know, frankly, if you're not being paid enough to live on, then bump it with a trumpet. I ain't going to play, you know? I mean, I need money, you know? So then, you know, the publishers were promoting like they're promoting now, you know? I mean, some kid has written this, like, 1,000-page novel about New York in the 70s and gave him $2 million. And you know that book is not going to earn back $2 million, and he's not going to be anything in 5 years except a pathetic wreck. And, you know, but this is how they do, you know? I mean, so I don't want to be part of that. I mean,
I have to ask you something. I was online a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't heard of this book. And I saw that Vanity Fair did a big article on this kid, who I don't think was born in the 70s.
No. We should say who he is.
The name of the book, I think, is City on Fire.
City
is that right?
City on Fire, yeah.
And I know, I lived in New York in the 70s, and I remember my reaction when I saw that this kid who hadn't been born had written what people are now taking as the definitive 70s Dickens novel. How would you describe your initial reaction when you got wind of this?
You know, I don't have any proprietary feeling about New York in the 70s. I don't even care about it. But there was an article, a profile of the guy.
His name is Garth Risk Hallberg.
Thank you.
And yeah, it was clear from the profile that this guy was a very calculating person. He had just really kind of decided, like, this was how he was going to get a lot of money and write a bestseller. The thing that's striking to me is you pay somebody $2 million to take a dump on the sidewalk, and the New York Times is going to write, like, a, you know, review of it. Mm-hmm. You know, you pay $2 million to somebody to, I don't know what.
Well, of course, because that's the story. The money is the story.
The money is the story. And then Frank Rich, now this week, you know, that wastebasket, has... you know, written this glowing review of it for the, I mean, I...
But Chico Cacatani, you know, basically said it was a work of genius.
Well, you know, anything you give $2 million to has to be called a work of genius by the New York Times and these hacks. I mean, Chico Cacatani, who called her the stupidest woman in New York? I think I know if you could top her, but, you know, the... I don't care about Jonathan Franz, and my weekend was ruined because FT Lunch was with him. I mean, you know, and I look forward to that. I look forward to Agony Uncle, and I look forward to FT Lunch. And look who it was, Jonathan Franz, and this, bleh. I mean, you know, I mean, what could be more of a bromide than Jonathan Franz, than this jumped up middle brow throwback to the great macho, I'd rather have a pig. I'd rather somebody was just a pig than be Jonathan Franzen.
My friend David Wittenberg's writing a book about big culture, about this idea of the biggest building. Every Arab country has to have the biggest building now, and the size of a movie budget determines the success of the movie, because the size becomes the news, and then the size becomes part of the attraction for an audience.
Yeah, no, but I'm fine with all of that. I mean, I'm fine with big culture being what it is. A lot of the things in big culture I enjoy, you know? Mm. What I object to isn't giving $2 million to this jerk. What I object to is people telling me that it's great literature. What I object to is people telling me that I should pay attention to it. Me. You know, I'm sorry. I have some sense of who I am, you know, and I don't care if I see it in every airport in the world. I might even read it if I have a really long flight, you know, but don't tell me that this is God's gift to literature, because that is just bull.
Oh, let me ask you this, since you used the phrase bump it with a trumpet, what's your relationship to the American songbook and to musicals?
I actually hate them.
Oh, okay.
I, you know, because it's such a gay cliche, you know, to be into Judy Garland and Broadway musicals and all that crap. I do actually, part of me loves them too, because I have a kind of, I mean, there are some wonderful things in the American musical theater, no question about it. I mean, things that surpass, I just could only have an ironic relationship to them, not the kind of, I can't take them seriously, but I love them on that level. I mean, I hate the gay thing. I was trapped at dinner a couple of years ago with what I eventually perceived as a Stephen Sondheim coven.
And that scares me.
Yeah,
that
no,
totally
is that not redundant?
Well, yeah. But also, the first person I went out with in New York was the guy that wrote Godspell. And that
Stephen Schwartz?
No, Tabalak, the guy that wrote the book.
Yeah.
I was living with this actress, you know, crashing at her house, basically her apartment. She brought him in one night because she was doing a play with him, and he sort of dropped on top of me.
Like all great relationships.
That's the way everything starts, you know. And it was a particularly brutal winter, I should say, in New York. And his place was warmer than hers, so I went and lived with him for a while. Made all this money on Godspell, right? And he'd set up his parents and a maisonette on Central Park West, and he had like a duplex on 82nd Street, and all he was collecting Fabergé eggs. I mean, that's how much money he made on the news. But he was also a deacon of St. John, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, you know, which, if that is not already wretch-inducing. His family observed every liturgical holiday on the calendar, including, you know, the Feast of the Circumcision and this and that. And I was obliged for a while to go to these hideous parties where all of these show tune queens and aspiring bum boy actors would gather around the piano and sing Sondheim and, you know, all this stuff. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm really allergic to it. I mean, just like...
It's so refreshing.
Well... I'm sorry, Laurie.
It's all right. I'll get over it.
Listen, I spend my whole life being the wrong kind of homosexual. That's just how it is.
The book is I Can Give You Anything But Love. Gary Indiana, thanks for coming in to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you.
Forgetful of a promise of love, you're sharing another's.
I'm Seth Greenland here with Tom Lutz and Laurie Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, KPFK 90.7. FM. While the gods of love look down. Tom, you talked to Carolina de Robertis about her novel Gods of Tango, which had some fascinating gender politics in it, didn't it?
The Gods of Tango is about a woman who emigrates from Italy and ends up changing gender, becoming a man in a sense, to be a player in a tango band in Buenos Aires.
As one does.
And I had just come back from Uruguay, so I was very excited to talk to her, and we had a great time downtown where she was as part of a literary festival.
Let's listen.
We could start with the Borges epigraph.
Sure, that sounds great.
Okay. One of the three epigraphs is Borges's statement, convert the outrage of the years into music. Why that epigraph?
Jorge Luis Borges is a central voice of Argentinian and Rioplatense, meaning Argentinian and Uruguayan literature. But also that line really captures something about what music is able to do in society and in the human soul, which is that it can take some of our deepest emotions and most complex, ineffable experiences and really transform them into something that lasts, a sound, a melody, a feeling that others can capture by listening to the music, even generations later. And that's something that the tango really did for Argentinian society. The profound emotion, the many immigrants who came from Europe and other places, mixed with the poor folks who were living in the tenements at the time, black people who were living in Buenos Aires, people who were coming in from doing rural work among the gauchos. There was this incredible cultural crucible in which so many experiences were being had that were never documented, and music can capture those experiences.
And the outrage? How does the outrage figure into that?
The outrage, I think, comes from having experiences that get silenced and that don't have room to be fully witnessed or seen. And many of the characters in my book grapple with that kind of silence.
Yeah, there's some real parallels, I'm sure you're aware of, between tango and its history and, in America, blues and country music.
That's absolutely correct.
Right? Lower class musics that eventually get appropriated by a middle class, right? In both cases, via Paris.
Absolutely. Right. That is exactly right. They are very much parallel histories, an unvarnished beginning that was disdained, perhaps, by the more elite members of the same society, and that then arose and was appropriated. I mean, really that very parallel trajectory. And I think when we think about the blues, there is an acknowledgement that the blues really capture with beauty and musical artistry a lot of the very intense emotion and grief and rage that came with being African American in this country. Although I think that certainly with the tango, I think one of the things that draws people to the tango and gives it this global popularity that it has today is that it does, the sound of tango music really does capture something about yearning and longing. And many people listening to it who are not of the same dispossessed communities from which it arose may experience in that yearning a sense of yearning for a lover, an erotic yearning, or simply a yearning of loneliness, or project onto it whatever it is that they wish, which is one of the things that art is created to do, to live inside each observer.
And one of the things that dance music is definitely designed to do.
Certainly, certainly. So others may certainly read that yearning in a different way. But when you look at the history of the tango, it's very clear that that yearning really comes from the longing of these immigrants displaced from their homelands.
I was so fascinated by these very different tango cultures, the kind of concert tango culture, very polite applause and superb musicianship, and then the clubs on the edge of town that are an underground scene, and they're very classicist. That is, they're playing records that are very scratchy, and they're all from the 20s and the 30s. And your book, The Gods of Tango, is set, it begins in 1913.
Correct.
And it's set in this classical period.
Right.
And so does that mean that you're on that side of the tango wars?
No. It does not mean I'm on that side of the tango wars. It means that I really wanted to tell the story of the origins of the tango, the birthplace of the tango. I was really fascinated about those early, underdocumented times in which the musicians were, you know, not classically trained. They were coming from the conventillos, which were the tenements of the time. They were poor. They were passionate about this music. And I was fascinated by that time. And I do love that classical tango. I do love the old guard music. And I love what happened with the tango canción in the 1920s, you know, as led most prominently by Carlos Gardel and the song ballad versions of the tango. I love Piazzolla, all of it. I mean, I also love the Cotan Project and Bajo Fondo, which are these, you know, 21st century groups that create, you know, fusion with hip hop and jazz and tango sounds. I believe that music evolves and can and should evolve. That's how we got the tango in the first place, is through evolution.
Now, the story in The Gods of Tango has another important layer, right, which is that this young woman who comes from Italy and is an Italian immigrant shows up in 1913. She's 17 years old and shows up to meet her husband, only to find that she's a 17-year-old widow.
Yes, right?
And as she starts to play the violin, she does it as a man. Now, there are, of course, some famous jazz stories like this, the story of Billy Tipton.
Right. Yes.
And you know this story.
The true story of Billy Tipton.
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so that you knew that story going into writing this. Was that an influence?
I did not know the story of Billy Tipton when I was going into this, but it became an influence along the way. So I was about 2 years into writing this book. I already knew that Leda was going to pass. She was already passing as a man. She was having this experience, and that was an essential component of my being able to put this female protagonist into this very male-dominated world. And really, the only women who were in these cafes and indeed brothels where the tango was mostly being played were prostitutes. And so it was really her only option for being able to enter on this level.
Yeah. Another connection to the blues, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. Another connection to the to the blues. But, and one of the things that gave it its richness and also its sort of illicit sense to upper classes in its early stages. Mm-hmm. So I then discovered Billy Tipton when I was already deep into the writing of the book and learned that Billy Tipton is a true and actual person who passed for 52 years as a man, biologically female. And it wasn't until he died that his identity was discovered. He had three marriages. He raised adopted children into adulthood who never knew about his biological gender. And there's an incredible biography that I read by Diane Wood Middlebrook that served as an essential part of my research. So though I didn't get the idea from Billy Tipton, I was able to get a lot of details that helped me with the veracity of my character's experience, how to handle going to the bathroom, you know, during shows, and all of these kinds of, you know, very real essential bits and details to survival. And really was able to kind of study Billy Tipton's experience. Billy Tipton's first wife never knew until after he died decades later, and is absolutely clear about the fact that she had pregnancy scares in the time in which she was married to him. So when I read that, I realized that I actually needed to get a whole lot bolder in my portrait. That's one of the gifts that Billy Tipton gave me.
Interesting, yeah. Carolina de Robertis, thanks so much for talking to us.
Such a joy and pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Family and all your cousins. The view is excellent. There is no comparison.
Thanks to Gary Indiana, Carolina de Robertis. Our apologies once again. This is getting old. To BJ Novak, we are so sorry, but we ran out of time. He said he will come back next week. Of course he did. Our thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin, our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano, our new assistant, Aviva de Kornfeld. There's a new podcast, a literary thing we want to call your attention to. It's called Lit Up, hosted by Angela Ledgerwood and Emily Gould. It's a podcast about books, writers, literary things where they claim that no topic is
verboten.
Is too personal or too weird, they say. I wonder.
Let's get on the show.
Let's see if we can find a topic that they may want to shy away from.
We have to challenge them. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. See you next week. Can't wait. We'll be there. You better be.